This is Jason Solomons, welcoming you back to Film Weekly. On this bombastic edition of the show, we speak to Half Nelson director Ryan Fleck to find out about his new film, Sugar, a story of curveballs in the life of a young Dominican baseball player pitching his dream in America's major leagues. From players on the up to players on the down, Dustin Hoffman plays Harvey Shine in British director Joel Hopkins' Last Chance Harvey. Joel joins us in the studio to tell us about writing a screenplay for the mighty talents of Mr. Hoffman and Emma Thompson. Sam Brooks will be back as we review Crash Bang Wallop Terminator Salvation, starring a raging Christian Bale. We talk about the social realist classic This Sporting Life and Sugar. Yes, it's more fun than being chased by a T-800 Model 101 cyborg. It's Film Weekly. Sugar is the latest film from writing-directing team Ryan Fleck and Anna Boden, who made the splash of all splashes with their debut, Half Nelson, landing an Oscar nomination for its young star, Ryan Gosling. This time, their preoccupation with flawed dreamers has taken them to the Dominican Republic, to the dreams of Miguel Sugar Santos, the talented young baseball player, on his way to Iowa to make it in the major leagues.
Can you understand what I'm saying? You need to know that your actions have consequences. So we're going to take the cost of that water unit that you busted up and take it out of your check. That's not anything that your family back home is going to be too proud of, is it? So you need to think about channeling that frustration you're feeling onto the field, into practice. Channel it into working harder.
I work hard. Every day I work hard.
Yes, work harder, goddammit. You think you're the only one on this team works hard?
Yo no entiendo lo que tú dices. Tú hablas muy rápido. Yo no te entiendo.
Look, I know you think I don't know what you're going through, but I do. I've been on the mountain before. I've played through pain. I've been in your exact situation before. And I've struggled, too.
Linguistic and cultural hurdles are just some of the challenges thrown at Sugar, acted brilliantly by newcomer Algenis Perez Soto. And to tell us more about this very particular take on the American dream, I'm joined now by Ryan Fleck from New York. Congratulations on Sugar, Ryan. I had you on the show way back when for Half Nelson. It feels years ago. I can't believe we're still doing this. And you made a whole other movie and spent months in the Dominican Republic getting to know your lead character. I suppose that's the kind of what's so exciting about your film is the way that one empathizes with your lead character so much because you must have taken so much trouble to find him and find his story. Just tell me a bit about the how you managed to find this tale.
You know, a lot of kids growing up here in the United States, they are baseball fans, much like people growing up over in your country in Europe, obsess over the game of football. We look at baseball every summer. There's a lot of hope and pain associated with the teams that we grew up watching. So like a lot of kids, I felt like I knew a lot about the game. I understood the rules. I understood the history of the game, the stats. I followed it very closely. But what I did not know until very recently was that every Major League Baseball team here in the United States has their own private academy down in the Dominican Republic where players are trained and housed and fed in order to come to the United States and play minor league ball, and the good ones will rise up and hopefully make it to the big leagues and make their teams lots of money. So
this was the shock to me. We start in your film with a shot of this kind of, was it the Kansas City, what are they called, the Kansas City Cubs?
Yeah, we call them the Knights.
The Kansas City Knights, and there they are, and you know, they've got this baseball game. It's almost kind of like a Guantanamo Bay kind of thing. It's this little outpost of America on this Caribbean island. I was like, my God, so if Kansas City Knights have got one, well then the Yankees must have one, and everyone must have one, but the place must be rife with it.
They all do. Every team has their own special place carved out of the jungle, and you know, amidst all this poverty all over the island, there is, exactly like you said, there's an armed guard, and you pass through the gates, and all of a sudden you're in this very pristine, well-kept environment. It's quite an interesting sight to behold.
Presumably it must be worth it in terms of the economy. It must be very cheap to set up this camp. And if one of these camps turns up a jewel, a diamond, like Sammy Sosa, who's the legend who came from Dominican Republic, it's worth it in terms of millions for their investment. Is that right?
That's the idea, yeah. I mean, these guys can be signed for so much less money, far less money than your average American player coming out of high school or college who command a lot more money. These guys, it's getting much better. They all have agents now, and the good ones are being signed for a lot more money. But when this whole operation started, they were signing these guys for $1,000, $1,500, you know, which is pennies.
Right. So what I liked about your film is that we've got this sports story, the guy who wants to make it big, and that's a kind of big-hearted, kind of good old-fashioned sports movie. But then you've also got this kind of subtle colonial kind of an exploitative element that comes in that you don't make too much of, Ryan. That you're mentioning it there in an interview that, you know, some of these kids were signed for $1,000, whereas some of the US kids are signed for $1,000,000. So it's a very kind of subtle form of exploitation that's going on. But you don't make too much of that in the film. Otherwise, it would become too polemical, I guess.
Yeah, well, and it's also a very complicated issue that I don't have a full grasp on. You know, and I didn't want to completely say, oh, this is 100% exploitation, because I have to say, if the answer is getting rid of all of these camps because it's exploitative, you're going to remove a huge aspect of the economy to these Dominican neighborhoods, because on one hand, it is a tremendous opportunity for these players to be signed and have an opportunity to travel and make money for their families, to pull their families out of poverty. But on the other hand, they're dropping out of school at incredibly young ages to pursue this dream, which is fairly unrealistic. You know, they can't all make it, you know, and that's really what this story is about, that not everyone can become Sammy Sosa.
Yeah, it's sheer numbers, isn't it? And sheer luck and sheer determination. You have to train and train and train. And that's what I loved about your film, actually, because it's a kind of, it takes place in the shadows. You know, I was living every pitch with him. I was feeling every kind of niggle of injury. I was feeling every kind of, you know, every strike and cheering every, you know, every ball. And it was kind of empathetic. And I think that's because your method made you such empathetic with the hero. You really felt for this kind of open-faced actor. Tell us where you found him and how you work with him, because he'd never acted before.
That's right. You know, once we decided this was the movie we wanted to make and we wanted it to feel real and authentic, we learned pretty quickly that there weren't any movie stars that could fill these shoes of a young Dominican baseball player. So we went down to the Dominican Republic, and it was really tricky. It was probably the most difficult part of making the film, was driving around to all these baseball fields in the middle of nowhere and breaking out a video camera and talking to players and interviewing them, asking them if they were interested in auditioning for a movie. We saw about 600 players this way. It was pretty tricky. We were very happy when we found the guy, Alhenis is his name, Alhenis Perez Soto, who plays Miguel in the movie. He's got this incredible piercing presence. His eyes say so much without the need for words.
It seems to me, in a way, your film, which was about the kind of people having dreams and trying to kind of bat their way or pitch their way to out of poverty, in a way, your film can do that to your actor, because, you know, no one had seen him before. And if he can't make it as a baseball player, well, he's going to make it as a movie star playing a baseball player. You kind of bless him with this kind of double-edged bat, if you like.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's a curse. I'm not sure. But it's, being an actor is probably just as difficult as succeeding as a baseball player. So we'll see. You know, it's a perfect role for him, and he really nailed it. And I hope that he can continue to find more roles in the future.
But he's an actor now, isn't he?
He's working on it. He's working on it. We'll see what happens.
Good. And what about the pressure, right? Because the last time we spoke, you had this wonderful success with Half Nelson, which I loved. Great music from Broken Social Scene. Wonderful performance from Ryan Gosling. And there you were. He got an Academy Award nomination. Great news for your film. Were you under pressure to then make a sort of a much bigger budget film? Because I'm impressed the way you stuck to a kind of sort of grittier, more rootsy feel, even. In fact, this film is even kind of less starry than the one you started with.
There might have been pressure, but the amount of time that it took for Half Nelson to come out, basically in it premiered in Sundance in January 2006. And at that time, we wanted to make this movie, Sugar. We were working on researching and started working on an outline for it. So when we went to Sundance, before Half Nelson had even been sold to a distributor, we were pitching this movie to other companies. And we sort of got the ball rolling. And they had seen Half Nelson, and nobody knew that it would be the success that it was with the Oscar nomination. But these companies had seen Half Nelson, and they wanted to make another movie with us. So we got very lucky within that window. But who knows? Maybe if we were a little bit slower about it, we would have felt more pressure to make a bigger movie with more movie stars.
It's interesting, because I think the techniques that you use, that you can see the similarities between Half Nelson and Sugar, they are very kind of identification with this lead character. You immediately feel for this guy, who may or may not be completely heroic in every way. Ryan Gosling's character is, you know, very, very flawed. And our guy Sugar here is also flawed as well, to a heartbreaking degree.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. few people pick up on that, because he seems like he is such a nice, sweet character. You know, we call him Sugar, and but he certainly does have some flaws, and they present themselves, especially later on in the film, as he becomes to be more self-aware of his dilemma.
Ryan Fleck, lovely to speak to you again. Please join us for the next film. When's that going to be?
The next film? I don't know. Hopefully we'll start shooting something later this year, but it always feels like a miracle anytime you're making a movie, so I'm always cautiously optimistic and not quite believing I'm going to make a movie.
And you're still going to write and direct with your writing and directing partner, Anna Bowden. I always imagine amazing that you two managed to do it together, and you know, one of you is going to be you're going to go solo at some point, like George Michael and Andrew Ridgely, and it's going to be heartbreaking.
Boy, I don't know. We're having a good time working together so far, and we've had good luck on the two movies, so we'll give it a shot again.
Brilliant. Well, do come back on film, Willie. As I say, I loved it. Very heartfelt, very beautifully done, and very nicely judged. Every artistic choice was brilliantly done. Ryan Fleck, congratulations on Sugar.
Take care.
Sugar is my recommendation of the week, and it's on general release in the UK from Friday, the 5th of June. Stepping up to the plate now, Zan Brooks joins me in the Film Weekly pod studio. Welcome back, Zan. Nice to see you.
Thank you very much, Jason.
Sugar, we just heard from Ryan Fleck there. Were you a fan of this one?
I really was. And I went in thinking, oh, God, another sporting movie.
Yeah, because it's not your favourite sort of genre.
It's really not. And, you know, it works. They always work up to a point, but they work in the most sort of cheap way possible. And why I thought this worked superbly is that it's almost like an anti-sporting movie, in that it kind of dismantles it all and basically shows the rags-to-riches cliché as being a lie. And it's really a film, it's a baseball film where it doesn't actually matter who wins and who hits the home run. That's not its focus
at all.
Yeah,
it's the sort of business of it. It reminded me of Hoop Dreams, of course.
Absolutely,
the documentary.
Yeah.
And it was just a beautiful, empathetic way of working as well. I was a big fan of Half Nelson, as I told Ryan there, which I thought was just a great central performance. Got that nomination for Ryan Gosling.
He was great in that.
And this guy's terrific in it, this newcomer that they found.
Eugenis Perez Soto, who's a non-professional actor, who really does just embody the film, and you kind of take his journey with him. You know, sometimes literally, so there's a marvellous tracking shot in there, isn't it, where the camera is sort of behind his head as he walks out of the hotel and through the sort of the video arcades and the bowling alleys, and you have a sense that this is the real America and that he's totally adrift in this kind of neon bright exploitative world.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is a beautiful moment, and he sees the guy in long shot. I mean, I just thought the skill of it was really key to building this portrait up of
and very
guy.
Subtly done, and really not going for the easy emotions, but beautifully moving and truthful, I think.
Yeah, good. Well, I'm glad you liked it, because it's sort of my recommendation of the week here on Film Weekly. But it is up against a big hitter, and none bigger than Christian Bale as John Connor in Terminator 4 or Terminator Salvation. Before we lock horns over Terminator, let's have a little clip which finds out that machines, unlike humans, which you may at this point may actually decide that actually even Film Weekly has an off button, but Terminators also do.
John Connor, prophesized leader of the resistance. Soldier, you put every man and woman in this sub in jeopardy with your little frogman stunt.
What the hell are you doing here?
What did we find down there?
You'll be briefed on a need-to-know basis.
Well, I need to know. Because my men died down in that hole. What did we find down there?
We found a solution, Connor, that can end this war once and for all. We know the machines use shortwave transmitters to communicate. Our intel has located a hidden signal under the primary channel. It allows for direct control of the machines.
Skynet's a machine, unlike all machines. It has an off switch.
Does it work?
Will it work?
Yes.
Have we field tested it?
No.
Give it to me.
Well, if you're still tuned, we're still here. Zan Brooks and Jason Solomon's about to review Terminator Salvation. Zan, it's serious stuff.
Is it, Jason?
Well, it thinks
really,
it is.
It really thinks
Christian
it is.
Christian Bale thinks
it?
It's serious.
It's the apocalypse, so I guess it must be serious.
Exactly.
It's the post-nuclear dystopia with John Connor leading the resistance against the evil robots.
Are you a Terminator franchise
kind
fan?
Kind of, to a point. I thought that the first one was a little overrated, that everyone seems to sort of hold up as this Citizen Kane of action movies.
Yeah, and isn't it one of the rare occasions where T2...
T2 is better, yeah. It's the Godfather 2 syndrome, isn't it? It's one of those rare moments where the sequel is better. And T2 I really liked a lot. And Toy Story 2 as well. Mm. Maybe it's all the T films that they do better on. Terminator 3, even, I quite enjoyed, but I thought this was kind of rubbish.
Right.
And it was like, weirdly, it was like being sucked into, you know, to push the rubbish metaphor a bit further, it was like being sucked into a kind of waste disposal unit. It was all these kind of gnashing jaws and flying bits of metal.
Well, the world is a sort of weight of garbage dump, isn't it, at this point?
And I guess that is the point, but it's not a particularly pleasant place to go.
Sort of post-Wall-E, you know, Wall-E takes it on a bit further, where the world is just...
Yeah, and Wall-E has, you know, those other little elements, like, you know, a heart and a point and some soul.
No, I don't know what it is, but I actually quite enjoyed this film.
Well, I'm despairing.
I know everyone said it was rubbish, and I thought it was actually all right. I mean, it starts with this kind of bum, 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 bum. Oh my God! And I was like, oh my. And then Christian Bale just comes, swoops down, and goes, oh my God! And I was like, oh my God, Christian.
Yeah, it was like a sort of rock opera, wasn't it? It was so kind of over the top.
I haven't
like
seen
that.
We Will Rock You, but I've got a feeling. It looks a bit like this.
I'm sure. And a bit of, was it Starlight Express or whatever?
Yes, it could be. Yeah. What do you mean you haven't seen Starlight Express? Jeffrey Daniels, body popping. Come on, Zan, get with the beat. I don't know why. I just thought this was kind of, it sort of worked. Because as big blockbustery nonsense things from the summer go, I quite like the sort of, the kind of detritus of this. And the kind of, it went from sequence to sequence. I was not particularly kind of emotionally involved in it. But for some reason, I thought it was all right.
I thought it was so one note that it became so monotonous. And if you're going to give me a summer blockbuster, give me kind of Star Trek any day.
Yeah, I mean, they have similar kind of mind-bending takes on the future.
They have that, and they also have the sort of the weird hybrid. You have the Sam Worthington, who plays a sort of a hybrid of man and robot. So he's like a little bit like Spock, but he's like sort of Spock for idiots, isn't he? But he's sort of talking about the difference between men and machines. There's a lot of very kind of elementary, you know, theorising in there amongst all the sort of the battling of robots.
The war against the machine. But there's a line in it that says, the human condition no longer applies to you. And I thought that was kind of rather kind of a good line in a terrible movie.
Well, it's certainly the emblematic line for this film, because there's no kind of human pulse in this film at all.
Yeah, you think it's made by McGee, who I think did genius work in the first Charlie's Angels
movie.
Yes,
that was a classic, wasn't it? And that was another sequel that was very good, wasn't it? The second Charlie's
Full
Angel.
Throttle.
Full Throttle.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had to earn that title.
I see, I don't know why, but some reason that it... Because it had all the cheesiness of kind of post-apocalyptic dystopian sci-fi that should have. But I think it was Bale's unrelenting kind of machismo and grumpiness and kind of like... He scared the living daylights out of me. Much scarier in this than I thought he was as Batman, when I couldn't hear half the things he said
in Batman. Yeah, but not quite as scary as he was in that amazing leaked rant from the set, where he's screaming at the director of photography for kind of breaking his mood. And obviously, you know, he does take it on board, doesn't he? He stays in character throughout. And here he is, he's a very angry man.
I kind of admire his committedness to
I like him. I quite like him as an actor, but here I found him a bit tiresome.
Right. Well, I mean, it is unrelenting in its kind of, as you say, the metal crash and kind of bombast. Danny Elfman's score, which you can hear on the show today, is kind of like full of that, all that bombast.
He barks as well at times, doesn't he, Christian Bale?
He does.
He kind of scowls and barks.
Yeah, absolutely, with that little beard. I mean, I just thought he was the scariest man I've ever seen. And I don't want to give him a bad review in case he comes after me. But I do, though, I have one enormous problem with the film, which I have to say, for some reason, I don't know why, but I did enjoy it. And this is all the things I hate about summer blockbusters, and I actually thought this was all right. They never end anymore.
No.
Why have Hollywood is petrified of bringing any film to an end in case there's a kind of sequel?
Yeah, because it's the franchise, isn't it? So you've got to keep it going. It's like the never-ending story, isn't it? There's that great line in The Simpsons where the lawyer in The Simpsons says, I sued the makers of the never-ending story because it actually did end. And you know, Hollywood has obviously learnt that lesson, and now these stories never end. They just open out.
If a filmmaker or a producer would have the balls to actually say, well, actually, this is what happens. Everyone one blows up and it's happy ending, or the war ends. But this one, that something ends and then they go, well, the battle was won, but the war is only just beginning.
Yeah.
And I think the tagline for the film is "The end begins."
Yeah.
So what does that mean? We're going to go back?
Well, I'm not going
to
go back.
You're not going back. You might have to.
I'm done with it. I'm terminated.
Zan, there's another sports movie out this week. We talked about Sugar earlier and how you don't normally like sports movies. And here's a very different sports movie. It was kind of, I suppose it's one of the first non-sporting sports movies. It's called This Sporting Life. Lindsay Anderson directing the great Richard Harris way, way back in
1963.
Well done, exactly.
Hi, Dad. What are you doing down here then? Did you sign? Had they signed your arm? They wouldn't have me, Dad. They wouldn't have me. You ought to have seen them. Around that weaver like a... a pack of dogs around a pitch. I told them what to do with the stinking, filthy bastard money.
So, of course, Richard Harris's big kind of explosion onto the big screen. It's back in kind of a very spruced up, new, kind of almost HD black and white, which tends to make put Richard Harris look very made up as well. He looks like
he's got real pancake makeup on, hasn't he? Maybe to make him look younger than he was.
Because
he was like mid-30s when he made this film.
Right, he was supposed to be a rugby league star playing for Wakefield Trinity, but they're just called City in the film. And there's lots of kind of still quite good footage of rugby league. I'm not a big rugby league expert at all. But there's lots of quite good sort of sporting footage in it, which I think has kind of meant the film has lasted for a long time, because it's always quite difficult to re stage sport. And this one does it quite well. It's very muddy, but it really is kind of British social realism at its grimmest.
Yeah, it
up
is,
north.
Isn't it? This is one of the great films of that sort of kitchen sink school. And Harris's performance is so sort of full throttle and furious and anguished that it is the sort of the riposte to the method acting school of sort of Brando and Montgomery Clift and James Dean that had just about preceded it. And I think this is really good and stands up well. I mean, it is dated in places, but it's also not subtle. I mean, it's quite a kind of crude film, but it's crudely powerful.
I'm wondering if Christian Bale watched a bit of Richard Harris in this.
He didn't watch enough, I don't think. He could have watched more. Because of that, I think that its anger and its intensity means that it hasn't really faded. Of those kitchen sink school films, I think my favourite is probably The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner with Tom Courtenay. I think that's an amazing film. And this is maybe one rung down, but it's still a superb tour de force from Harris and a very good debut from Lindsay Anderson, who we know for slightly more kind of experimental...
Yeah, he went on to do If and Lucky Man and collaborations with Malcolm McDowell, but very angry young man things. But what I loved about watching this again was the sort of fashion, and because it is about a sort of young footballer or rugby player kind of trying, and then there's the chairman and his wife and the Bentleys, and they're trying to kind of dine in the rooms and kind of, you know, being sniffy to waiters come over and say, "Oh, the duckling's very good tonight, madam." He goes, "Oh, bloody ducklings!"
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff. And I think that still sort of obtains for young sporting stars.
I think
and looking
so.
At Sugar and the way
exactly,
that
it's a great counterpoint to Sugar, because it is the kind of the raw matter of the talent who are being exploited.
Yeah, absolutely. That's This Sporting Life, back in glorious black and white on your big screens, thanks to Park Circus, who are doing this sort of thing. So well done to them. Thank you from Film Weekly to put British classics back where they belong on cinema screens. Zan Brooks, lovely to see you again. Thank you very much for joining us. Do catch up with Zan's writings, musings on film and literature on guardian.co.uk/film. While your multiplexes thunder to the deafening sounds of Terminator, a quieter, quirkier release will be playing close by. It's called Last Chance Harvey, and it stars Dustin Hoffman as the unlucky Harvey Shine, whose luck could be about to change when he comes across Kate, played by Emma Thompson.
That'll help.
What?
I said that'll help.
What, this?
Hmm.
Oh, yes, it will, and it is.
Right.
It'll help as much as that trashy novel and a glass of Chardonnay. I'm sorry, that was out of line.
Go away. Stop apologizing.
It's just that I had a really shitty day.
Join the club.
Oh, no, yours may have been shitty, but mine was shittier. Mine was major shitty, you know?
How shitty?
I missed the plane, I lost my job, and my daughter, who's getting married today, decided that she wanted her stepfather rather than me to give her away. Okay? And that took it to major shitty.
Fair enough, you win.
And so a very unlikely romance unfolds. To find out more about the film and the romance, I'm joined by its director, Joel Hopkins. Welcome to Film Weekly, Joel. Congratulations on Last Chance Harvey. Now, am I right? You wrote this specifically for Dustin Hoffman and Emma Thompson?
Yes. Basically, when I sat down and wrote the first draft, I clearly had them in my head.
They're a strange couple to have in one's head ever to put together. Where did you get the idea of them coming together?
Whenever I talked about this film, this idea to friends, and I would say Dustin Hoffman, Emma Thompson, people would take a beat and then go, "Ooh, yeah, no, that sounds interesting." I mean, they're not the most obvious couple. And that, I guess, is part of the attraction.
Mm. I mean, they were together in that Will Ferrell film, The Stranger Than Fiction. He was a professor and she was a sort of a blocked writer, wasn't she?
Yeah, that's really where I first got the idea. They had a couple of scenes in that film and they were very nice together. They were very natural together. They had, you know, smaller parts in that and slightly felt they were slightly underused in that film. So I thought, oh, you know, there's something there. And
it's almost like giving them a Knots Landing to that, yes. Dallas. Yes. Giving them a little kind of offshoot.
Spin-off movie, yes, yes. There you go. Now, also, I'm just on another note, I feel they... I boiled it down to when... They're both very, very funny people, yeah. and actors in a way. And when I looked at their sort of comic performances, they always... I always felt they both shared this sort of... They're funny, but there's always a sort of touch of sort of melancholy, and I always feel in their performances at the sort of root of it. And I think they share that. And then in the same breath, I'd say when they're doing sort of more dramatic stuff, I always feel there's a little glint in their, you know, a little smile.
There's always a comic kind of element, yeah, or something, yeah, going on.
So I would argue, you know, they are actually quite compatible like that.
I think they're both terrific in it. Particularly, I must say, Emma Thompson, who I think I haven't seen this good for ages. I know she's been sort of writing and being Nanny McPhee and having sort of big funny nose. So, yeah. But I thought she was absolutely... All that you said about the melancholy, yeah, when she's being funny and then the sort of funny when she's being serious. Yeah. It's all that... I wonder what you sort of the tenor of your film when you pitch it. You say it's a romantic comedy, it's a comedy drama, it's all of those things. I was never sure on which ground I was, which I think is probably what you wanted. I hope that's what you wanted.
Yeah, no, yes, it is. It's a hard one. I think we are, you know, to be blunt, I think we're selling it more as a rom-com, a romantic comedy. I mean, it is. It's a romantic film with funny bits in, but I think people do get surprised by the sort of the emotion in it and the sort of pathos, and so I guess it's a romantic dramedy would be the title.
It must be awful to be reduced to that as a writer, because, yeah, I know you wrote and directed and you got obviously careful. There are some lovely lines, lovely bits of wisdom in the film, which I really liked.
Thank you.
But it is one of those. It's quite old fashioned, Joel. Yeah. I mean, you're not that, yeah, old yourself.
No.
But it feels like, you know, there's something Brief Encounter-ish about it, and you know, that's not a bad comparison.
No, but, no, I'll take that.
But it, you don't get many films like that. You know, we've got Terminator out this week. You know, yours isn't as loud as that.
No. Yeah, no, it's quite a quiet film. No, I wish I could find a better term than old-fashioned, because I always fear that sort of slightly puts people off. But that's totally fair. It's sort of classic, hopefully, mm-hmm, sort of like a classic romantic movie in a way. I didn't sit down and think, OK... I'm going to make a sort of rom-com for older people. It just sort of, to be honest, like all these things, they always come out of very unromantic places. I had an in with Emma Thompson. I had been up to direct Nanny McPhee and didn't get the job, but she saw Jump Tomorrow and really liked it. And she took a meeting with me. And I thought, you know, that doesn't happen every day, that Emma Thompson, you know, says she wants to work with you sort of thing. And so I sort of went away and doggedly sat down and thought, okay, character that Emma could play, and that sort of Emma is the age she is, and so that sort of pushed me in that direction. And
it's
then
because she's also not, you know, she's quite happy not to do acting at all, isn't she? She's quite happy directing and writing.
Yeah. No, I mean, it has to be something that you know, something that clicks with her, and something that's really going to make her sort of, you know, she's amazing. She knows what she's going to do like a year in advance. I sat down with her, and she sort of opened her diary. said, okay, May, I'm doing this, blah, 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 blah. So I went through the year.
Where does one take a meeting with Emma Thompson? Is it in a sort of cafe in Willesden?
It's very low-key. I went to her house.
Oh, brilliant.
Which is the street. She lives on the same street she grew up in, which says a lot about her. No, she's a special, really special lady and very, very loyal. I can't say enough.
Good. So when she says, "Oh, I want to do your film," she does.
I mean, she really, you know, if she commits, she commits. And it might be in 6 months' time or a year's time, but she really, she doesn't sort of commit to things lightly or whatever. So she's very loyal like that. So, you know, again, that was the beginning of it. It was okay, you know, I've got an in with Emma. And you know, to be honest, I knew she knew Dustin. And so if I write a part for Dustin, you know, maybe Emma will give it to Dustin. And that is what happened, you know. And I managed to bypass the whole agent thing, which was, you know, is huge.
Oh, that's
in a way.
Very clever.
Yes.
Very smart. It's probably cheaper as well. What is it like when you finally get Dustin Hoffman and Emma Thompson on set? As you say, you think you know them and you think you've kind of seen so many films of them, going back to the Graduate and Midnight Cowboy and then going on through even to Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium, whatever what he's doing now.
Yeah.
When you actually get the two of them together and you actually start working with the two of them, what's that like? They're such experienced performers, such kind of wit, such kind of... Do they improvise? Do you have to kind of tie them down to your script?
I mean, I was... Just on a personal level, I was absolutely petrified. I mean, you know, they've got 4 Oscars between them. I mean, this is my second film, and what the hell am I going to tell them? I mean, one of the great things about filmmaking is you have no time, and immediately you're thrown into, like, making your first day, and, you know, airs and graces go out the window, and you just got to get it. On a sort of practical level... you know, Dustin is very hands-on. He in every aspect of the film, he was, but in a very positive way, in a very excited way. So he had a lot of suggestions, which, you know, you really needed to entertain. You know, I needed to set up a scenario where I would listen to his idea for the take, and we would... What we got into a pattern of doing was really like, you know, this is sort of Dustin's take and this is my take and maybe this is Emma's take in a way. And it's fine and it's great. And
you were fine with that. You're sort of saying, well, of course, yes, Dustin, let's do one for you. Yeah. And then can you just do it my way? And then Emma says, what about this way? Yeah. She's quite sort of, well, what about?
Yes. No, I mean, the challenge was time, you know, and making sure we had enough time to entertain everyone's ideas. I mean, for me, because I wrote the script, I had a pretty good idea what each scene was about and what I felt on the big part of the bigger picture, what was important in each scene. So I very quickly got into a habit of writing on a sort of post-it note or a card, you know, the key, what I felt were the key element of the scene was. And I sort of protected that. Like if I felt we were veering away from that, that's when I would sort of get a bit sort of stubborn or whatever.
So you'd have it on your clipboard
normally ended up sort of folded, screwed up in my pocket.
it's like angry ball.
This is I that really helped me in that. I it also gave me the confidence when we were veering off from script dialogue to say, okay, it's okay, you know, this does, that's good, that's better than what I wrote, but we're not, that's not going to screw us up later on down the line. That doesn't take us off in a sort of direction.
Thank you very much for coming in to Film Weekly, Joel Hopkins. Best of luck with Last Chance Harvey.
Cheers.
My thanks to Joel Hopkins there, and Last Chance Harvey goes on release here in the UK on Friday, the 5th of June. And that's all we've got for you this week. The music we've been featuring on this week's show is Danny Elfman's score to Terminator Salvation. Don't forget to pick up The Observer this Sunday to read my legendary trailer trash column, of course. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my Film Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye, and remember, we'll be back.